I will think about bigs. There is one present model to explain big diversity. I will show this model. Then I will show my point of view of this issue with my, based on my own experimental data. And at the end, I will introduce what I think are two different ways of saying evolution. Before I show the model, I will speak a little bit about anatomy. Then, the wings and the legs, this is a chicken embryo. Developed from just a single bud, this for the wing, this for the leg, but the beak developed from several of them. There are five buds for the upper beak and two buds for the lower beak. For the upper beak is the frontonasal mass, lateral nasal mass, two of them, and two bacillary buds. These five buds grow and fuse and form the upper beak. And then there are two mandibular buds that grow and fuse and form the lower beak. I will concentrate just on the upper beak, and this model is just on the upper beak.
What is the rough size there, so you compare the limb part and the beak part?
The face, you can see the face in this, in the embryo that is in the left, because it's... The limbs develop just from one single bud. With this right line, it's just one bud. But you can see here 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 for the upper beak and 2 for the lower beak. There is not just one bud. It's not clear? Okay. More or less. Then we. About the beta skeleton, at the beginning, at day 9, is just cartilage, and there is one rod for the upper beak and two rods for the lower beak. The rod in the upper beak is called nasal cartilage, and the rods in the lower beak are the Meckel cartilage. This cartilage is the scaffolding on the beak, and surrounding these rods, the mesenchyme develops into bone. Into membrane bone. Then at day 9 there is just cartilage, but here starts the development of the bone. You can see here the nasal cartilage and here the bone. Here there are more bone. The bone is in red and the cartilage in blue, no? And at day 12 there are most mesenchyme has developed into membrane bone. Then the upper beak is constituted by several bones, and each of them develops arise from a different bud. Okay. There are five buds for the upper beak, no? Then the bone on the tip, the premaxilla, arise from the frontonasal mass. The bud is in the middle. The bone, the nasal bones that are surrounding the nasal orifice, develop from the nasal mass, nasal buds, lateral buds. And all the bones from the lateral sides and the roof of the mouth develop from the maxillary buds. It's just a little bit of anatomy because the model speaks about the nasal cartilage, the premaxilla, and all these things. And if I don't introduce this, we can understand the model. This is the model, and it's, I think, from 2011, and the basic idea is that different beaks are the result of different skeletons, and that different skeletons are the result of different gene expression patterns. What I am telling now is what they did. Then the first step is by microarray or in situ experiments, you need to know what genes are expressed in differently in different species with different beaks, no? And these are the candidate genes. And according to them, these are five of the molecules that have different patterns in different species of Darwin finches. When you know these candidate genes, you can inject in the frontonasal mass, in the embryo, in the one of the parts of the face, a retrovirus with a sequence of these genes to know what happened if you overexpress these genes, no? You increase these molecules in the face. What happened? What do you do this? This is to know the role of these genes in the development of the beak. Then you put this at 4 days and you stop grow at 11 days. Then you can do both things. You can stain cartilage. Here, this is the nasal cartilage, and you can stain bone. This is the premaxilla bone, and these are the treated embryos, no? And you can compare this with the control ones, and you can see if these skeletal elements are different, no? Have been altered, and you can also make measurements of the big externally. Then you will express one gene, and you know if is altering the skeleton or the bone, and you also can measure if it's altering the beak, the set of the beak. No? Then, according to this model, BMP4 acomodulin alter the beak say, altering the nasal cartilage. This changes, and then the beak changes. And the other molecules alter the development of the premaxilla bone. That is here, no? And they do this conjointly, no? And when you alter the nasal cartilage or the bone or the premaxilla, you have a different beak. Then according to this model, when you alter BMP4, you can alter the depth and the width of the beak. When you alter camodulin, you are altering the length. And when you are altering this network, you are altering depth and length. No? And this is the model. What happened is that linear measurements is called conventional morphometric. Linear measurements are not suitable to analyze some kind of say, variability, because these two hypothetical peaks are completely different, but they have the same linear measurements. This is like a curved beak, and this is something that is not curved, no? But both of them have the same length, width, and depth. You understand this? Okay. Then with this model, you can analyze this kind of shape. You need what is called geometric morphometric analysis. In this kind of analysis, instead to take linear measurements, you take x and y coordinates of landmark points. And these landmark points will be, you can identify them in each specimen. Then you can analyze shape difference comparing this configuration of landmarks. When you do this, you keep the geometry of the strata you are studying, and this allows to study more shape variation than just linear measurements. And this, for example, with this analysis, you can see what can be to detect a change that is related with a curved beak. This will be the grid for a curved beak. No?
Sorry, just to understand. So the difference now is that you're measuring angles as well? Is that the thing?
No, I take x and y coordinates of points. This I don't know if the red color is not very clear. If this point, 4 points. I know the x and y coordinates. Then later I will speak more about this. Is then you have these coordinates, and you can analyze the set differences comparing these coordinates. The thing is that in this way, you keep the geometry, and you can analyze more set differences that just work with conventional morphometrics. The thing is that this model doesn't explain why there is a curve peak. And what happened is that you can induce a curve peak in a chicken embryo. Then from A to E, there are five embryos that have been treated with different substances called teratogens. And this is a normal embryo. It's at day 13. I don't know if you see that the peak is curved in all that. And this is less curved. No? It's something like a parrot peak. What this means is that using the chicken embryo, you can try to understand why there is a curve peak. And this is what I did.
So, what exactly were the treatments?
One moment. A is sulfamilamide, I think so. No, A is acetylpyrimidine, B boric acid, C is DEPT, D sulfamilamide, E valproic acid, and D is the control. No? I knew that they can alter the beat before I use them. Then I concentrated in...
Otherwise, do they develop normally?
What?
Rest of the body is normal?
No, sometimes you have alterations in the whole body, but I am just producing in the beat. Sometimes you have also in the limbs, in the wings.
Sorry, you can't hear any discussion
at the back. I will try what I can. Then the thing is that you can understand why a curve peak, something that this model doesn't explain, no? And I concentrated in valproic acid. The valproic acid altered the molecular machinery in many different ways. It's an anti-epileptic drug because in the adult blocks the ion channels that are related with the transmission of the neural signal. And in the embryo, when you put in the embryo, it's a teratogen. This substance increases the oxygen in the tissues, and when you increase the level of oxygen, you increase apoptosis. Apoptosis is cell death. And when you do this, you reduce the embryonic growth. It's very complex. That is all this. This is the pathway apoptosis, but it also alters proliferation and differentiation. The thing is that we injected valproic acid, 2 milligrams in 50 microliters of saline solution, in the yolk sac. This means systemic administration is not local, not just in the face or in some part of the body, it's in the whole system. Day four, and then we stopped development at day 5, 6, 7 till 12. Then the idea was to compare treated with control ones to understand what is happening in the face, and we use geometry morphometric analysis. A little bit about geometry morphometric analysis. You take digital images. Then you must take this Landmark points. Then you shall do a procrustal analysis that removes the shape that is arbitrary, that depends on the position you put the embryo, are never in the same position. Then rotating, scaling, rotating, translating, and scaling, you remove shape variability that is not real shape variability with procrustal analysis. Then here you have a new data set that is say difference between your specimens. Then when you have your superimposed or two specimens, you calculate a consensus configuration, is like a mean. Then you compare every specimen with the mean, and you feed this data to a function called thin plane spline, and the parameters that describe this function are the variables of your specimens. Okay, when you take the x and y coordinates, this is the raw data. You can compare this. You need to do all this analysis to have a new matrix that represent the shape of your exemplar. To the weight matrix, that is these parameters of the this function, you can apply conventional statistics. Then we apply visible component analysis to know the main shape patterns in our sample, and we also make a MANOVA to know if there is significant differences between treated and control. This is the result for 5 days. These are the landmark points. And this is the PCA, and this is the MANOVA table. The MANOVA table, if you see P is less than 0.05, this is insignificant, and this means that treated and control embryos are different, significantly different. Then this is the PCA, and the main differences are in the second axis. Treated are related with the maximum values of this axis, and control are this. And the main differences are in 0.15, 9 and 13. And you see in the treated, this is like concave, and in the control is more convex. This is one of the main differences at day 5. At day 6, another landmark points are not always the same, because it's something that is changing and you don't recognize the same points. And you sort of take the better points that are describing your face, no? This is day 6. Again, the control and treated are different. The main difference is this time is in the first PCA. There are controls. The minimum values are controls, and the maximum values are treated. And the main differences is in landmark 1, 4, 5. You see here that landmark 4 is below 1 and 5, and the distance between them is shorter. And in the treated one, landmark 4 is above 1 and 5, and the distance between them is longer. This is a 7, another landmark, significant differences in shape between embryos and control ones. And this time, the PC2 is where are the main differences. This is control. Again, landmark 4 is below 1 and 5, and here landmark 4 is above 1 and 5. What all this analysis means, from my point of view, is that the treated embryos have less expanded buds, their tips are more separated from each other, and the oral cavity is bigger because are less expanded and less just each other. If you see here, the treated is always like concave, and the other one is like convex. And this means this is more expanded, has grown more than the other one. I didn't finish the 12 days, but this is what happened next. These 8 days, this is growing forward, the beak is growing forward. And you see here an inflection at day 9, this is day 10, this is day 11, and day 12. This is the normal peak. In embryos, the face is flat, the peak is not growing forward, and you don't see an inflection at day 8, day 9. At day 8 is no inflection either. And at the end, it's very dark, these pictures, but I don't know if you see that you have something like this curved in relation, in comparison with the other one, no? The question is, if you put valproic acid, you reduce pad expansion. but how could a reduction in fat expansion have originated according? This is the principal question, no? Then it's more very important to know that different buds grow in different directions. The frontonasal mass is in the middle, grows in the mediolateral axis, it's something like that. And the lateral nasal tube is growing something like that in the mediolateral axis. And the maxillary buds are growing in the proximodistal axis, it's forward. Then what happens, the beak is not growing forward by itself, but it's growing when the frontonasal mass fuses with the maxillary buds. Here is the maxillary bud, it's far from the frontonasal mass, but this is growing, and this is closer and closer to the frontonasal mass. Here is more closer, and here it fuses. Now you have the frontonasal mass, and the maxillary buds are below this frontonasal mass. And the maxillary buds are growing in the proximal-distal axis, then now are lifting the frontonasal mass. I don't know if you understand. It's not something that is growing by itself like a bee. There's a cover, and the cover is lifted. No? Then what happens is that when you put valproic acid, and you reduce the expansion of the buds, the maxillary buds can lift the frontonasal mass. And this is why you have something that is clear. This, I think, is the developmental reason of a curvy. Well, now that we know this of the development, I want to talk.
Could you speak just a bit closer to the mic?
I need to. All this is about development, and I want to show how important it is to know this to understand evolution. And I think there are two different points of views, and this is what I want to introduce. Coming back to this model, if you see, we have here gene expression patterns at one stage of development, and they are just focusing the frontonasal mass and the upper beak. There is nothing in between. They don't say anything about beak morphogenesis, how these buds are growing and fusing, and nothing about this. Genes and upper beak. This, I think, is the idea of a genetic program, from my point of view. And I think this idea leads to the externalist view of evolution. Then, this idea of the genetic program is that genes encode for form, no? Form is encoded in genes. If form is encoded in genes, form is arbitrary. And if form is arbitrary, you are expecting that living matter takes one or another form. It's like a piece of plastic that needs something external to it that molds, take mold form, gives forms to this, no? And then, if living matter is something inert, is something non-intrinsically ordered, how biological form has been generated. And the idea is that natural selection has sculpted form to this inner matter. And when natural selection is the creative factor of evolution, you have machines constructed to meet some functional demands. And it's called externalism because the organism principle of form is external to the living matter. And we have here the idea of a genetic program, the idea of not intrinsically ordered matter, passive matter, inner matter, is related with natural selection as a creative factor and function explained form. The reason there are one function is because it's useful to perform some biological role. I think this is what defines this externality. The beaks is the paradigmatic example of this framework. You have Dando genetic mutations, then you have arbitrary allele morphological variation in any dimensions of any skeletal elements, and then natural selection selects the fitter ones to some functional role. At the end, what you have is tools, pigs, you have constructed pigs to fit on some food items. This, I think, is the most traditional idea about pigs. Then I want to show a video. It's a little bit long, but I think express what I want, so what I want to expect to say. This is how a bit is seen from this point of view.
Of the 10,000 bird species on Earth, only 5, all in the finch family, have crossed bills. The white-winged crossbill is found in the higher latitudes of North America, traveling from coast to coast in large flocks in search of white spruce trees. Females are greenish-yellow, males red, and both have 2 distinct white bars on the wings. Their unique crossed bill, with the lower mandible curving under the upper maxilla, is adapted to reach heavily protected seeds found under tough cone scales. To reach the seeds, a white wing places the tip of the curved lower mandible against the cone while inserting the upper maxilla under the scale. Beak partially open, the bird uses the curved mandible as a lever, twisting his head as he pries up the scale. He eats the seed, discarding the husk. The curve of the mandible provides the leverage needed to force the scale up, enabling crossbills to feed on seeds that are not accessible to other species. A white wing often twists the cone off and carries it to a perch where it holds the cone in one claw and rotates it like a corn cob. Lower mandibles cross either left or right, and each individual always holds the cone in the claw toward which their mandible curves. This ensures that the tip of the mandible is facing the cone, giving the bird the best leverage to quickly pluck the seeds. White wings are remarkably efficient at harvesting their food. An individual bird can eat up to 3,000 seeds per day. Crossbills are able to swiftly bypass a conifer's armor as a direct result of their specialized beaks, an excellent example of evolutionary adaptation.
They say this is an excellent example of adaptive evolution, no? What happened is that you can induce a curved beak in the chicken embryo putting a thick carbamate. With this example, I want to say that you don't need a gradual evolutionary process to generating a cross beak. It's a potential form of the developing system. No? I don't know if it's clear this. Okay, the cross beak can be very useful to eat in these conifer fruits, but it's not the reason of its existence. Then I will introduce the internalist view. In internalist view, living matter is not inert. It's something that can take form by itself, but it is intrinsic physical property. Then in this way, form can be arbitrary, but form is explained by the laws, the physical laws relevant to the developing tissues. Then, biological forms can be very useful to do some functional roles, but this is not the cause of their existence. They have an internal physical cause in the way they are generated during development. One thing is form generation, another thing is how this form has persisted. In the second step, maybe the functional role of these structures has played a role, but not in form generation. In form generation, what plays a role is the physics and chemistry of the living matter. Then we have a different picture here. And only this is to bring back physics to the study of form, of biological form. We have developmental programs that is not the same as the genetic program for development. That genes, of course, plays a role. Organizing is not just a spontaneous thing. There is genes, but these genes are not encoding form, but stabilizing and regulating potential forms of development. Then we have matter with intrinsic capacity to be ordered by itself. Form precede function, because function is something secondary that can be used for the spreading, but not for the generation. And we have here that natural selection is not a molding factor. And this is called internalist view because the cause of form is internal to living, intrinsic to living matter. Then here we have something a little bit different. You have, okay, random mutations or some environmental factors, but you don't have, organizers are no machines. Organizers are physical systems. Then all these genes, what are telling the parameters, initial and voluntary conditions of the system, then these mutations are not telling directly one element or one dimension or one element in this direction. What they are doing is alter the system, perturbing the system as a whole, and the system responds with another configuration. Then you have form here, and after form is generated, maybe its functional role, the function, the role the organism do with them, can have a role in the spreading. I think are two different things, form generation and form persistence. I just want to make some remarks. I think big curvature can be said that it's an emergent property because it's not a property of the frontonasal mass or the maxillary buds, but it's the result of the physical interactions between all these buds. Then it's a feature of the big that you can trace back to one bud. And another thing that I think is very important, that you are putting valproic acid and reducing boot expansion, but you don't have a small replica of the normal embryo. What you have is this. Then when you are altering the shape of the bud, you are ready, all the skeleton conjointly changes the shape of the cartilage and the bones. Then this idea that you can fine-tune every element, every dimension of every element, is at least a little bit limited. And to finish, we want to develop a new model for pig epodevo and rotate in the internalist point of view and bringing back the physics relevant to big morphogenesis. And before I finish, I want to thank to Vidya Ajundia for inviting me. I am a little bit there.
So you know, you said that natural selection is a molding factor in the externalist view, right? But don't you think that's a bit of a straw man? I mean, you know, it's something like Ayesha and others had been saying even previously, that this notion, it's just sort of a short form, I think. I mean, you say that natural selection is a molding factor. I think the intent of it is precisely what you have shown in your internalist view. The question is, don't you think that's a bit of a straw man?
If a straw argument is...
Okay.
A straw... Oh, a straw man, okay. The straw man, I see the straw man in this model, in PNAS in 2011, because they say this, the genetic program is there, I am not emitting anything. And they don't bring this mathematical model, it's nothing about physics, and they are telling you that natural selection has molded every bit to be perfect, to fit there or that. I am not inventing this. Maybe it's an astral man, but it's there, and it's public.
This is not a question, but some addition of some information. There are a large number of species, flowering plants, which are pollinated by birds. There are flowering plants which are pollinated by birds. Now the length of the birds, of course, is highly variable, and generally they harvest the nectar from those flowers where the corolla tube is matching the peak size, peak length.
It's okay.
Now in one of the interesting cases in Hawaii, one of the honey creepers, some decades back, it used to feed on lobelias. Lobelias are the flowers which have long tube and it has a longer beak. And now after the last 5 to 6 decades, these lobelias are no more available. Either they have become extinct or they have become extremely rare. So the bird has shifted its feeding to another flower which doesn't have corolla tube. There the nectar is available even for short peak length. Now what they did is, they have observed, they have collected the museum specimens, collected in during 19th century of the same species, and measured the peak length of museum specimens and compared the peak length of extinct birds, and they have shown significant reduction in the size of the beak in the present day birds which are feeding on other species, not on lobelias. So this has been interpreted as a evolutionary change because of the selection pressure brought about by the difference in the flower.
But to understand these changes, you need to understand what has happened during beak development. I am interested in explaining for if these beaks are better to eat on nectar, or they are later sorted, and eat another thing. I agree, it doesn't matter, it's fine. But this is not the explanation of these forms from my point of view. I think you need to see in development what happened during development that now the beak is sorted. This is what I am interested. There are other people that is more interested in more ecological questions, and it's fine. But what happened is that with this idea of a genetic program, I am morphologist, and I'm interested in I don't know how to explain in a theory of morphogenesis. And this is impossible to do if the genetic program for development is true. Because if there is a genetic program for development, there is nothing essential in form. You can construct a theory. Every bit is the result of a different program, something historical. Then for me, very important to have this very clear, because if the genetic program is true, what I am trying to pursue it is fails. Then I think the genetic program is not true, then I try to... My passion is to develop a theory of morphogenesis.
I'm trying to understand the distinction you're making. It seems to me that if one breaks apart the notion of natural selection into what produces the variation in the first place, which is what you're really interested in, and then what leads to differential survival and reproductive success, which is what's the central core of natural selection, I mean, in a sense, one can bring together both the internist and the externist views. I mean, they're not actually mutually exclusive.
No, I don't see them as exclusive. But in what I am interested in, you need to be very clear that natural selection plays a role in the spreading.
That's right.
But not in the generation. Now they both are mixed, completely mixed. And everybody thinks, much of the people, that natural selection is molding. It's spreading, but not molding, from my point of view.
I just want to put a small comment. Do you know the little New Zealand whaler which has its bill turned just to one side?
The whole beak.
Yeah, the whole beak is turned to one side. And they all have the same type of beak. And they feed under stones.
Do you see when you're done with this? I mean.
Yes. You ought to see it.
It's called, Paul, do you know?
Is it called a turnbill or a turnbill? Yes. It's a very significant bird, very tame.
Yeah, what I wanted to comment on this was, like what you had told, deep blood bias again, because when there is a change in the reduction in the length of the beak, so we tend to believe and prove ourselves that it is because of evolution. Yes, there has been a phenotypic change in this case, but not necessarily there was a genotypic change. For example, for the...
These are mostly interpretations. Whether it is because of the plasticity or whether it is genetic change. But most of these evolutionary concepts have been interpretations rather than demonstrations.
And the film you saw, you can see that frostbills were adapted to feed on spruce. The spruce is a gymnosperm which is thought to be very primitive. And the evolution, if you consider the evolutionary trend, spruce evolved much earlier than the frostbills had evolved. So there is some mismatch in all this.
Sort of carrying on with what Mohini said, we're coming back to the maxillary bud and the mandibular bud. Yes, the mechanism by which bud form develops and the beak develops is one thing. And then the relative success of different beak forms in allowing those birds to survive and reproduce is another thing. But the fact that there is a maxillary bud, there is a mandibular bud, the two are opposed to each other, aren't these also the outcomes of natural selection? Why are they there? Why do you have two buds? Five buds that you said in the...
This, even us, we have five buds. It's something like the back plan of vertebrates. How this originate or half originate is your question.
For example,
I don't know, but why for natural selection? I don't understand why it's nothing intrinsic to the way the embryo develops.
Is this true of all vertebrates?
Yes, we have this phase when we are using
Yeah, so I was just wondering, is it possible that during vertebrate phylogeny or during the origin of the vertebrates, this was an adaptive feature? Is that something that you can rule out or is this unlikely?
I don't know why this is something adaptive, I don't know why. It's very useful, but I don't think it's sort of adaptive.
In invertebrates also.
You see this in every
Why is it necessary that having two buds versus three buds is a product of natural selection? Maybe.
Excuse me, I'm not making any claim at all that this is necessary.
Okay.
All I'm asking is, can you rule it out?
Okay, because I thought you were making the claim or asking her, you know, whether that was a product of natural. It's not necessary. Maybe you come up with the same form in a different way.
We have this model, will be easy to understand the origin of this bug.
The model for development looks very nice, but the fact that there is a substrate on which development works or on which your model works, would that not be at least partly an outcome of natural selection?
But can we not do? Maybe the options are just you sort of test this.
There's more explanation in natural selection.
Can I try again? So, you know, like coming back to yesterday's talk, the one that I was trying to say that in cognition you can think about what the system is doing and why it's doing it, and you can sort of separate the question from how it is doing it. So it seems to me like when you separate the externalist, internalist, the internalist really is the mechanism that generates the form, and then what you call the externalist is sort of the mechanism that selects the form, and you know what you call spreading. So I don't see them as a contradiction. I see them as two aspects of what
of course.
Overall is.
No, the problem is that in the internalist externalist point of view, this internalist view is not regulator. Then the what is the external the role of the external factor does both errors, generates the form and what spreads the form. This is the problem.
Is it a question of relative emphasis that you're talking about, and you're claiming that the conventional, let's say, developmental biology and evolution picture emphasizes the externalist viewpoint?
Yes, there are what is called evo-devo, that if you see development is understood like the switch of off and on genes. It's like a development is conceived like a genetic problem. And for me, this is the problem. You call this evo-devo, but development is just a genetic problem. It's nothing else. It doesn't have any, it's not a new cause in evolution. Then I think most of the evo-devo is in external. You need to bring physics to the study of development to bring the internalist point of view.
So, design.
Design. For me, it doesn't matter. Design can be natural selection or God is the same. It's fate.
Well, if there are no other questions, thanks again very much.